Okay, so I am here once again with Layla Lalami, who is most recently the author of Secret Sun. Layla, how are you doing?
I'm very well. I love your enthusiasm.
Of course. I'm very enthusiastic. It's great to talk with you and actually be a much better interviewer than I was last time. But this time we're doing the one-on-one, the mano a womano. I don't know. Something like
mano
that.
Mano a womano.
How are you doing? Are you doing okay?
I'm well, thanks.
All right. You're well.
Yes.
Okay. We'll get some life here. Okay. Wild comparison, but it must be said. Your book is titled Secret Sun. And when I read it, I immediately thought to myself, Richard Wright's Native Son. And in thinking about the book, I noticed, I was thinking that, you know, Yosef was also very similar to Bigger Thomas. He actually begins by looking at the movies, just as Bigger does, to get his sense of the world. He gets a job with a rich family, through a rich family, and I'm kind of curious about this. I started looking at this going, there's quite a lot of similarities here, so I must ask, was Richard Wright possibly any kind of lingering influence on this particular book? Where did the name come from? The title come from? Or
well,
am I just completely batty as usual?
No. I mean, that's a very valid question. I mean, and the answer is no. I wasn't at all thinking about that. In fact, when I was working on the book and I turned the final manuscript into my editor, she read it and she said, "This is just like Invisible Man."
Yeah.
Because she says, you know, the party, the brotherhood, you know, and the whole sort of like the whole idea of the fact that some of the characters can't see, that blindness is sort of a theme in that book. And then in my book, most of the main characters are sort of wearing masks and pretending that they are that which they're not. And I hadn't even read Invisible Man. So that was pretty amusing when she pointed that. And so, of course, I went out and I got it and I read it. And so, yes, it was kind of interesting. So the answer is no, it wasn't really something I thought about. And in fact, in terms of the title, it's something that came much, much later. The original title was The Outsider, and that was a title from a long time ago. And of course, you know, the minute the publisher saw that was going to be the title, you know, my editor called, she's like, we're going to have to change the title. And I said, but why? You know, it's a perfect title. And, you know, it's not like Camus, you know, I'm thinking, you know, Albert Camus, The Stranger. In England, the edition is called The Outsider. And that's what I was thinking of. She's like, who cares? It's not Camus. It's S.E. Hinton's The Outsiders. And then I said, oh.
And you had the other manuscript called Texie. You know.
So anyway, so for a while, you know, I mean, I really resisted. I said, can't we just, you know, add an adjective and keep it or something? You know, I was trying to keep that title because I just thought that it would fit. And then when Salman Rushdie was reading from The Enchantress of Florence in L.A., I went to see him read. And as he was signing my copy, he asked, you know, so when's your new novel coming out? And I said, next spring. And he said, what is it called? And I said, The Outsider. And then he said, you do realize that title is already taken. And I said, yes. And he said, that's like calling a book Heart of Darkness. So I thought, you know, yeah, I really do need to change the title, or it'll be confusing. And so that's how Secret Sun came about, because it was simple and descriptive. Also because with the first book, when I had a longer title, and it seemed to be really confusing for readers, and nobody could seem to remember what it was. People couldn't remember to find it, you know. So I was determined with this one to find something that would be easy enough to remember, that wouldn't be too long or belabored. And so Secret Sun was kind of the obvious choice.
It was such a confusing title that Ayelen Waldman had a similar title.
Oh my God, can you imagine? And at that point, the catalogs were already out. There was nothing we could do. There was nothing that her or her publisher could do about it, right? Because her book was called Love and Other Impossible Pursuits. And I mean, how do you come up? It's not as if pursuits is that common of a word. It's not like the construction. It was just so odd. But, you know, I mean, the books maybe were aimed for different readers. I never really found that people confused one for the others.
Yeah.
So maybe publishers worry about that stuff unduly or too much. I don't know.
Or maybe there's just more commonalities within the course of fiction than we really realize. It's sort of like perhaps there's about 6,000 different possible title configurations or plot configurations, and everybody's kind of mishmashing, and really it comes down to voice, perhaps.
Well, I mean, it happens. I mean, you've heard about Colm Tóibín and Brooklyn.
Yeah.
I mean, and there was another novel called Brooklyn.
They had to duke it out over the title.
Yes, but didn't they have the same publisher?
Yeah.
Well, so that's why it got sorted out. But if it was a different publisher, they might not even have realized until the catalogs were printed. And
the
then
real
it's too
Brooklyn.
Late.
Yeah.
As opposed to the fake one.
Yeah, I know. I wanted to ask, speaking of titles and speaking of parallels, we should probably talk about the fact that you depict two scenes in this book from two different perspectives. I'm curious, were these perspectives motivated by essentially the class roles that you have in the book between the father-son dynamic or the scenario in which you have Yusuf inhabiting two different classes? Did this, I suppose, inform or motivate or justify or essentially inspire the shifting perspectives? Or
in other words, why the hell?
Yeah, I'm just curious, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Exactly.
Well, you know, I mean, I had that from a fairly early draft in the book, that this moment when Yusuf finally meets his father is such an important moment in the book. It seemed to me that telling it only from his point of view wasn't enough, because, I mean, there are two people in this scene, and to both of them, this is an incredible moment in their lives. It's a very important moment. And I was actually curious how going through the same scene, how each of them would remember it, how each of them would perceive it. So of course it wouldn't be in exactly the same way. So even though on the surface of it the two scenes might seem, it might seem that they're actually repeated,
yeah,
the dialogue is actually not identical. There are slight differences. Some of the lines are the same, some of the lines are not the same,
yeah,
which sort of matches how we remember, you know, conversations that we have with our friends. I mean, you and I could be having a conversation, walk away, and repeat it to somebody else, and it wouldn't come out the same way. So to me, it seemed important to show the way in which our perceptions limit our view of reality. I mean, everything that we believe is based on our perceptions. So if our perceptions are not similar, how could these two people really sort of ever reach a moment in which they're truly communicating? I never felt that they really did in the book.
Yeah.
And then in the second repetition, that was slightly different. In that situation, I wanted to sort of show different motivations, because when the mother meets Amal, she has her own reasons for doing what she does. And then when Amal goes to see her, she also has a different goal in that scene. And so each one of them is going to take something very different from that encounter, and I wanted to show that too. So it really was a way, first of all, it was a way of just playing with that perception of reality, which is a big theme in the book. And it seemed to me to move the plot forward in a sort of an interesting way.
Yeah.
Not everybody's going to like it. In fact, it's very interesting because some people either love it or hate it. So it'll be interesting to see how people react to it.
Well, I also wanted to ask you about the certain character restrictions. Yusuf, for example, he smokes, but he doesn't really drink. In fact, when he drinks with his dad, he's kind of sort of like not used to liquor. And even when he does, in fact, get the apartment, he's still not really drinking. So it's almost as if you're suggesting with this that there's a part of him that can't quite be corrupted. And I'm curious if this was a consideration in devising the character.
Well, I mean, I don't really equate, you know, drinking with corruption in the least. I mean, I just think that, you know, very simply, if this was a young man who wasn't used to it when he was growing up, and then, you know, his father drinks and there's alcohol in the apartment, he would try it, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he would become a regular drinker. I mean, if you haven't really grown up with it, you're not necessarily going to fall over head over heels over it. So, you know, it just seemed to fit that this was something he might do occasionally, but not really be that interested in.
Yeah. I also should point out, since I last, when we last talked, I had chided you on the patting on the back as a sort of non-masculine manner or the way that it was described. However, in this, I'm going to go ahead and turn around and say, oh, well, you know, Layla, you did a pretty good job getting the masculine swagger right.
Are you serious? I don't even remember that from the first interview.
We had this two-minute exchange in which I was, like, saying, you know, patting on the back the way that it was done, and it was some really needlessly nitpicky criticism of mine. Yeah,
that's
I did.
Funny.
I did, yeah.
See, now I remember it. Now that you mention it.
Right,
you were saying that it wasn't. Yes, yes. Oh, and it's amazing that you remember.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Now I remember what you were saying. Isn't that funny? But you don't think it's a problem? There's no padding in this.
No,
book?
Well,
there
is. I liked the fact that you have him being this kind of, you know, young womanizer, and the uncertainty. It really struck me as that of a kind of young, nervous, you know, young man who is going out to life. But I must ask, did you was Alexander the guy who you turned to get the sort of authenticity right?
No, not at all. I mean, I just, you know, literally just use words and sort of immerse myself in them and try and look at the world that I've created through the eyes of this character. I still, you know, I mean, it's so hard. The more different a character is from you, the harder you have to work at having empathy with him and, you know, in this case, him. And you know, to work on your imagination to make sure that you've really sort of inhabited, like, breathed life into him. And certainly he's very different from me, so there was a lot of work involved. But it's nice to know that he's a more convincing male character than my first than in the first book.
Well, why masculinity more in this book than in any of the stories in Hope? I'm curious.
Well, I mean, in Hope, two of the characters are male and two are female. And in a way, in this book, it's kind of the same thing, although the focus is really on Yusuf, because we do get a chapter from the point of view of the father, a chapter from the point of view of the mother, and a chapter from the point of view of the sister, but the focus really remains on Yusuf. I think the reason is simply because, you know, I mean, first of all, the character just came to me and it happened to be a man, but I think I'm uncomfortable. I feel like if I write about a woman, like, there's always this assumption that I'm writing about
you.
Yes, yeah. And I'm not comfortable with that, and I think that's why all these smoke and mirrors, like, it's much more interesting to me to write about a man, because then, you know, that question doesn't even arise, and then I can be free to create and do whatever I want with him. And
then why UCLA? Because immediately, in fact, I saw a few reviews saying, yeah, she's clearly drawing from her own personal experience.
I didn't go to UCLA, but it was sort of, in that sense, I picked a university in LA only because that's where I live, and it seemed a little bit easier in terms of handling space, to pick a place that I knew. But yes, I know. I mean, people immediately think, even with that minor character, it must be you. No, it's not me. So you can see. I wonder why this idea that it must be autobiography. I really wonder why some authors get asked about that, you know, whether the work is based on experience, or if they all get asked, you know, where'd you come up with that? I don't know.
Is this one of the reasons why you shuddered? This is my only blog question. This is the only one of the reasons why you
shuddered
down.
You're welcome to ask as many as
you
want.
No, but I don't want to do what everybody else is doing. Like, yes, Layla Lalami, blogger and novelist. Because I just think that these are bullshit distinctions, quite frankly. But I mean, but that particular tag, I mean, Moorish girl, that is a very specific domain, that is a very specific identity. And so as a result, perhaps people read autobiographical elements in your fiction. Perhaps because, and I'm curious if maybe this is one of the reasons why you actually ended up shuttering that domain or redirecting it.
No, it redirects. So it's still there. I still own the domain name. I changed it for very pragmatic reasons, really, because I would show up, you know, for a reading or for an event, and people would be familiar with Moorish Girl, but they had no idea that it was me.
Yeah.
Or vice versa, that they knew me but didn't know that I was the person who was also blogging. And it just seemed easier once the book came out, because I needed a website of my own anyway, and there were going to be other books that were going to be integrated, to just kind of put the whole thing in one place instead of maintaining two different sites. And then, and I actually continued blogging fairly regularly. In the last year, however, I found that, you know, well, there's a couple of things. One is that it seems that all of publishing stories cycle, and it's the same stories over and over, and I got tired of that. And also because true attention to literature isn't as maybe as common as attention to sort of publishing, and And I didn't have time, and it just requires so much time. And I, you know, I just, between teaching and working on the book, it just became impossible. So now, I mean, literally, it's hard as it is to maintain it. You know, it's like one post a day, and
you're
that's blissfully
it. Blissfully unaware of literary news.
I mean, and, you know, I mean, I still read, you know, several blogs, but I, you know, I try to limit my intake of all of that because I just, I mean, I could spend the whole day on it, and I have maybe an hour or two a day in which I can read everything, news and everything. So I have to basically parcel out my time between everything. And I think really it's this book that did that, because the novel required so much undivided attention.
Yeah.
That towards the end, I was just so desperate to be done with it. So desperate. I would have done anything. I mean, I, you know, I just wanted to have, you know, 3 or 4 hours where nobody interrupted me and I could work on it. And then that's how it, you know, I got used to it after that, to only spend an hour or two. Before, I could spend, you know, several hours a day, and it, you know, and now I can't anymore.
I have a character question going back to the novel as opposed to the blogging. I don't want to give the novel away, but Amin, Yusuf's friend in the slums, he's driven to violence. I mean, you have, of course, the glass incident in the cafe. And then there's, of course, his involvement at the end of the novel, and I, again, don't want to give it away. The fact that he shares a name of a dictator is also quite interesting, although probably unintentional.
Yeah, I mean, that's very common. That's a very common name.
I guess my question, though, is if he is the kind of representative friend from the slums, why is there this violent association? Because there's nothing really in the early part of the book that suggests he's going to be this violent. I mean, yeah, he's kind of like the sort of the seedy accomplice and all that, but that struck me as a kind of interesting sort of trajectory. And there's also the risk there when you think in terms of where people come from topographically. There's a sort of stereotypical association. Oh, yes, violence equals slums. And so I'm curious as to why you steered in that particular direction.
Well, I mean, there are several clues in the book. So for one thing, I mean, you can see that he, at the beginning of the book, I mean, is fairly apolitical. I mean, if you remember when there's that riot at the university, he has no interest in that. He's not at all, interested in taking parts. And he just feels that that's none of his concern. And then as the book progresses, he obviously has this girlfriend that he's been seeing for a while, but he isn't doing so well in school. He can't graduate. He can't find the job. She ends up marrying somebody else. He's feeling depressed. And then the fact that Yusuf moves out, and that's really his best friend, and then he's left behind, sort of, and kind of abandoned in a way. And so the party, in some sense, provides a home and a family with that cafe, and with, you know, they're always there, you know. And so and also he's starting, I don't know, there are also some hints that he's doing drugs in the book. And then when Yusuf returns, obviously there's a little bit of violence on his part. And I always felt that he was more vulnerable in that sense to reacting in the same way that that Yusuf reacts, really, you know, in either being driven to or believing that that is the only solution, that that violence is the only solution. I should mention that it was never my intention to suggest that there is a link between, you know, living in the slums and being violent. But in the fact of the matter is, in Morocco, in the first time that there were terrorist attacks, which was in 2003, all of the young men that had been involved in that, they all came from a single slum in outside Casablanca. And then when it happened again 5 years later, it was the exact same scenario.
Yeah.
So in Morocco, it seems because I don't believe that terrorism has a single cause, I don't believe that, you know, killing somebody has a single cause, I don't believe that violence has a single cause. And I think that this is where the personal matters, the personal is paramount, in the sense that somebody else who might have gone through the same experiences, I mean, might not have reacted in the same way, but this particular man does, and Yusuf does as well. So So for the people who took part in these terrorist attacks, there were definitely personal reasons as well as political. Not just they're poor, therefore they get angry, therefore they, you know.
Yeah.
Sure, poverty does play a role, and sure, disenfranchisement does play a role, and, you know, all of these things are connected. And in this case of these particular people, that's what happened.
But why not subvert the expectations of the people who come and get involved with terrorism? Why not, say, go after someone from a different background or a different different class or a different... I mean,
but
why
I think
not?
In a way it is a little bit subversive at the end, because I think the expectation is that it is going to be the party that is always going to be involved in this, and to a certain extent it is, but without revealing the ending, you know who's actually pulling the strings here. So it is sort of subversive in the sense that it shows that it's all kind of it's almost as if it's bigger than us, really, this whole thing, this violence, that nobody can really stop it, and maybe nobody wants to stop it. So
here's a question. I mean, when Yusuf is in his apartment, you have a brown falcon with a twig in its beak flying to the roof of the building. Yusuf observes this particular bird. But this is interesting to me because this is essentially foreshadows Yusuf's essentially his experience in the school about how much he wants to submerge himself into this education. And I'm curious as to why you opted for a symbol along the lines of a bird as opposed to something that was more emotional or psychological, some sort of telling sign, a gesture as opposed to a symbol.
Well, I mean, when I was living in Casablanca in 2007, we were living on the sixth floor of an apartment building. And every morning as we were having coffee, I would watch. There were two falcons, actually. And the reason I realized there were falcons is at 4 a.m. they would come and they would sit on the windowsill and start shrieking. And I was like, what is that noise? And I had to look it up on Google to figure out. I mean, literally, like, you know, figuring out, looking up the description of the bird, putting it into Google with the sound and figuring out what kind of a falcon it was. It was a Barbary falcon, in case you're curious.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it was really interesting seeing them in this sort of really urban environment, like flying from one end of a building to the other end, back and forth and back and forth. And I was really interested in that image because to me it just seemed as if they didn't have a home, that they just kept going back and forth without really ever settling anywhere. And so when I used that image in the book, it was really meant to suggest that even though he is in this new apartment where he thinks that he's finally come home, that really is, there is no sense of home. I mean, he doesn't have that. That's not the answer. And I don't think at that moment that he realizes it.
Yeah.
So that's what the image to me was meant to symbolize.
But aside from drawing from this falcon, this Barbary falcon that you observed, I'm curious when you feel it's right to put a symbol there instead of, say, a kind of emotional or psychological reaction. Is there a particular...
That's really interesting. You know, when do you decide that during the process of writing narrative that you're going to go for sort of psychological explanation or for emotional explanation as opposed to using something...
Or symbolic in this case, yeah.
Or to use something that is, as opposed to explanation, something that is more suggestive, something that is more symbolic. And I think it really just depends on the situation the character is in. If it's something... I wonder, it is absolutely organic. It's something that, you know, that you do sort of in the spur of the moment. But I wonder if, you know, if I had to analyze it, I wonder if it's because if it is something that is fairly clear, then you want to go for the symbol so it's not as direct. And if it is really complicated, then maybe you do want to go for the narrative, because for the sort of psychological explanation to sort of walk the reader through that chain of thought that led to wherever it's supposed to lead. Maybe that's what it is, I don't know. But certainly it's not something that I can articulate simply, you know, in this situation I do this and in that situation I do that. I suppose it just depends on what fits in the actual scene and in the actual moment.
Yeah, I ask because it seems to me that this novel is far more sequential in action than the stories in Hope,
yeah,
in the sense
yeah.
that it's very driven
yes.
by actions and
yes,
gestures and
yes.
looks that advance the plot forward.
Yes.
And then you have this moment with the falcon, and so it's quite an interesting shakeup. I'm wondering if almost it was a way for you to, I suppose, vary the action up. As
no, but that's a really interesting point, because I think you're absolutely right that in this book... that there is more action. I think it's because in working with such, the book was actually originally a lot longer, and I ended up cutting a lot. And I think as I was working through the book, it was almost my way of moving forward to have it sort of, you know, scene by scene by scene. And scene involves a lot of action. But it was also sort of, the scenes were the building blocks that led me from page one to the end of the book. And so maybe that's why it seems that it's sort of driven by that action, because I was, you know, kind of walking my way through the end of the book. But yeah, that's, you know, maybe with another book it might be different, but certainly with this one, that's what seemed to fit. It is very different than the first one, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, since this book touches upon censorship issues, I'm curious why you didn't explicitly reference the Western Sahara separatist movement, which is big in Morocco. It's largely through embarrassing, libelous actions of government officials and ministers, as opposed to the separatist movement. I'm curious why you shied away or didn't actually pursue that, because that seems to me what is causing a lot of the problems and lots of the censorship, and even, you know, the censorship also of YouTube for a few days and Live Journal and alike. I mean, there's this concern over the these viewpoints. So I'm curious as to why dwell specifically on the government ministers and the like and the blind item.
I do, in fact, talk about it, because in the book, when I mentioned the different sort of student organizations, one of the student organizations that I mentioned is a Sahrawi student organization, who are students who come from the south and then they study there and have those views. You know, I have to tell you that in Morocco, even if there is a Western separatist movement, it's very much in the minority. The vast majority of Moroccans support having Sahara within the confines of the country, and look at it as a sort of decolonization problem that has gone on for 35 years. So it is mentioned in the book. Maybe it's not mentioned too much because it wasn't really what I was interested in. And I think that Western Sahara is only one of three issues that the government tends to use
crack
censorship
yeah.
for, you know? That's one. The other one is anything having to do with religion and Islam, because I think the government is really interested in being perceived as being sort of a leader on that issue, and they want to be able to dictate the discourse as opposed to letting various other parties dictate that discourse. And the third, they're called red lines, is basically anything having to do with the personal life of the king, any sort of criticism of him and all of that. So those are the three. Yeah. So all of those three things. And in the book, you can see that the journalist at one time or another sort of runs into one or the other problems. It's fairly rare, actually, for journalists to get into trouble about Western Sahara, simply because, like most Moroccans, they actually support the fact that Sahara is part of Morocco. So it's very rare you'll see a censorship issue of a journalist that is actually within Morocco, a Moroccan journalist within Morocco that is connected to Western Sahara. What you see more and more of is, for example, if they write something having to do with the king or having to do with politics or having to do with Islam, then there are censorship issues. But it's more rare when it's about Western Sahara.
So Casablanca magazine is more Telquel?
Isn't that funny that, you know, people are asking, is it this? No, I mean, it's obviously a fictional magazine, and it's not even a very clever title at that. And it's not Telquel at all, but Telquel is only one of many magazines that have run afoul of the authorities. They take turns, you see.
Yeah.
So, you know, every single major title has run into problems at one point or another with the government.
Yeah. But it's also a novel that features the rare instance of a college student actually being able to be a freelancer for a music magazine. In this climate, I had to sort of raise my eyebrow and say, "Hey, can I get this guy's job?"
I don't know who he's
actually, like, you know, like
working
up
for.
Yeah, because Rolling Stone ain't hiring. I assure you that. You know.
I love it. That's a great detail. That's very funny, Ed. Very funny.
Okay,
but well observed.
Yes.
You know.
But I mean, you know, this is, I suppose, is a problem. I mean,
could you even care about these particular things, or is it, do you have to leave the details just vague enough so that they are essentially timeless? I mean, you worked on this for years.
Well,
so
I just wanted to give him a job that basically to the parents would seem like a joke, and,
yeah.
and that, you know, freelancing for a music magazine. I know that to the parents of somebody like Amal, it's just ridiculous. It's
yeah.
not something that they would take seriously.
Sure.
But your point about there being so few gigs like that is quite well taken.
Yeah. Nabil is essentially, initially, he's hesitant to give information about his family to Yusuf. And then, well, a chapter later, he's in fact giving Yusuf his apartment. What causes this grand shift of trust? Because here's a guy who has resources to check up on people. I was a little suspicious of this.
Well, no, because, I mean, the apartment is just about money. It's just property. And to him, you know, it's no big deal to set up his son in that apartment. It's the way he might set up a mistress in that apartment. It says nothing about how emotionally, like how much he's willing to let Yusuf into his family. I mean, the fact that he gives him the apartment is, this is just a sort of a transaction. It's about money. It's not about, Yusuf never gets to meet the wife, never gets to see the house where his father lives, never gets to see his half-sister. So it's really not a relationship in the way, it's not an emotional generosity, it's
yeah.
just a financial generosity.
But he's got the journalist checking up on him, who's probably, and who, you know, is going to maybe like put two and two together, who's approaching him like, hey, can you help me, because I've got this libelous action, can you go ahead and help me out and use your principles that you once had? So that's why I guess I
don't understand. What does the journalist have to do with that?
Well, the journalist could, you know, if he's constantly not helping the journalist, then the journalist might turn around and, you know, go against him because, you know, he's not cooperating. So therefore, it's like, I mean, that's the one thing I'm just curious. It can't all be about just a financial transaction. He's talking to the journalist in this apartment with Yusuf there. And so that's why I was like a little, hey, what's going on here?
Well, no, I mean, it was basically a meeting with a friend, and he had it there only because this was probably not the kind of friend he wanted to have over at the house. Or, I mean, because this is something having to do with politics that he's not really involving his wife in. But nothing more than that. It wasn't, maybe it didn't work for you, but well. Yeah, I don't.
Do you view Yusuf stealing the paperweight as a financial transaction?
You know, to this day, I have no idea why he does that.
Really?
Yeah, I was in the middle of the scene, and before I knew it, he was walking down the elevator with it.
Yeah.
And it just, I don't know.
I kept thinking it was like Biff from Death of a Salesman or something.
Oh my God.
But instead of a fountain pen, it was a paperweight. I don't know.
Very clever. No, I wasn't thinking of... You know, to this day, I don't know why he does that. I mean, I think... I don't know. And the fact that it turns up later on in the book...
Yeah.
That, again, I mean, literally two lines before it happened, I didn't know it was going to be on that desk, and then it just...
Maybe you needed Chekhov's gun. Maybe that's what this is all about.
Yes, maybe.
I mean, intuitively, I mean, when you introduce a character or an element or an object along these lines, I mean, you know, to what degree is your subconscious sort of saying, hey, I got to go ahead and put things in here that I can follow up later,
you know,
and resolve
honestly,
and wrap things up?
Yes, I mean, honestly, it really did happen at the level of the subconscious. And I couldn't tell you why he steals it or why. I mean, it seemed fitting to me that the friend would convince him to sell it. I mean, that was just something that fit with the character. But... why it would then turn up on Hatim's desk, I don't know. I honestly, it just seemed to be I was just following my intuition with that. Maybe there is a larger symbolic subconscious
meaning
to it.
Or maybe you had a really painful, cathartic, and emotional experience with a paperweight that you're just not going to share. I mean, that
I wish,
you
because
had,
then
like,
the story would be a lot more interesting.
At 8 years old, Layla, that paperweight that you took secretly and nobody told anybody about...
Not really.
I don't know. It's your life, not mine. So, I mean, I'm just thinking that you had to have some sort of experience with a paperweight here. But.
No, not really. Nothing interesting ever happened to me.
Nothing? So you have nothing interesting in your personal life to draw from, hence this creation, hence this... this leads me to wonder about the connection between personal experience and invention. I mean, do you find that you're more comfortable inventing as opposed to drawing from real-life incidents?
I mean, yeah, because the whole point is in fiction to make it up. And so that's the fun part about it, is to make it up. But even when you make it up, you look around you and life is so, I mean, I remember recently I was having dinner with Nadim Aslam and I asked him, I don't know if you've read the Maps of Lost Lovers, but there is a scene in Maps of Lost Lovers where a young girl is suffering from depression, and this is taking place in a sort of Pakistani family in I guess it was Yorkshire, if I remember correctly. So this very closed sort of community, and the girl is suffering from depression. She's a teenager, and the parents bring in some sort of crazy imam / witch doctor who starts to beat her in an effort to sort of exorcise the demon. It's like an exorcism. They bring him in for that. And at the end of that scene, he makes her pee on an electric heater, which electrocutes her and she dies. And I asked Nadim, you know, did you make that up? And he's like, of course not. He's like, that actually happened. And he had read about it or heard about it. Because you can't make shit like that up, you know? And so it's interesting because, I mean, you imagine and you create. And yet life also offers you the craziest bits of material that you'd be a fool not to use in some way. And so I think that... yes, it is. The fun of it is to create, but also everything that happens around us either inspires us or feeds us in some way. There might be a detail, there might be something that I notice about someone that I want to use in the book, and I certainly do that too. Yeah.
But if you agree that truth is stranger than fiction, and I certainly agree with that phrase, you've just told me that you find yourself more comfortable with invention. So either you're comfortable with the least strange aspect, or perhaps there's some sort of melange here that is really the part of the equation.
No, but that's exactly what I meant. I mean, you make it up, but at the same time, you know, how can you not use everything that you have around you? Everything that you have around you. You can't do it otherwise.
How much of that is too much, would you say, in terms of, like, you know, using the things around you?
Well, because, I mean, in reality, like, for example, in fiction, you almost have to turn the dial down. Because if you were to create completely realist fiction, nobody would believe it. Because, look, I mean, you know, truth is stranger than fiction, right? And so if fiction is exactly the reality is, then people are going to say, you can't make stuff like that. I mean, that it's too implausible for it to have happened. I mean... if you had told us, I don't know, 6 or 7 months ago that the government would be taking, I don't know how many trillions of taxpayer money and giving them to all these, I mean, crazy, you know? But it happens, and so it's...
Or that pot would be legalized in California, possibly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It just seems that, you know, in fiction, you almost have to make it less crazy in order for it to be believable. You have to make it less, you have to turn the dial down in a way.
But on a certain level, you can't be concerned about believability. You have to be concerned about how true it feels.
Yes, definitely. But see, all of these things are in a way inseparable. That's why you're guided by your emotion, and that's why you're guided by your own feelings and your own ethical sense and your own sense of reality and your own literature. And I mean, it is a very personal thing, for sure.
Yeah, got it. Well, Layla, thanks very much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Goodbye to you, my trusted friend. We've known each other since we were 9 or 10. Together we've climbed hills and trees, learned of love and ABC, and skinned our hearts and skinned our knees. Goodbye, my friend, it's hard to die when all the birds are singing in the sky. Now that the spring is in the air, pretty girls are everywhere. Think of me and I'll be there. We had joy, we had fun, we had seasons in the sun, but the hills that we climbed were just seasons out of time. Goodbye, Papa, please pray for me.